Christmas as planned. In England, those living in Tier 4 areas should not mix with anyone outside their own household at Christmas, though support bubbles will remain in place for those at particular risk of loneliness or isolation.
After the announcement, chaos ensued as people scrambled to leave ahead of the midnight deadline. People bundled up presents and essentials and set out hoping to save their Christmas plans after England's Chief Medical Officer Chris Whitty suggested they unpack.
I want to put some numbers out there because I think that helps to explain why I'm going to give the answer that I'm going to give. But my short answer would be, please unpack it at this stage.
Officials say that the ban on Tier 4 Christmas visits is unenforceable. And to make things worse, hundreds of flights were cancelled after the UK's closest allies cut transport with it due to fears about the new COVID-19 strain. The decision meant closing off the UK's most important artery with mainland Europe, a step British Transport Minister Grant Shapps said was surprising, especially as, according to him, the new strain is already in continental Europe.
We tend to be more aware of the variants faster. And there have been thousands of variants of coronavirus. It's just that the particular one that we've seen in Kent and London, the thing which has led to the Tier 4 lockdown, is a particularly virulent variant of the virus. So it means that it spreads more easily. We've detected that first, but we know already that the cases have been found in continental Europe and other countries.
The chaos hit just days before the United Kingdom was due to exit the EU's orbit with or without a trade deal. Brexit negotiators Michel Barnier and Lord Frost met in Brussels Sunday, but yet again, an agreement was not reached. In view of the situation, Brexit negotiations could be extended. Bianca Rahimi, London.
In each of the 27 EU nations, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine will start being used in less than a week's time, on the 27th of December. The European Medicines Agency has given its approval and has played down concerns that the new highly contagious COVID-19 variant spreading in England will not respond to the vaccine.
These are issues that need to be fully scientifically assessed. At the moment, we can say that there is no evidence to suggest that the vaccine will not work against the new variant of the coronavirus.
The UK is now isolated as countries around the world impose travel restrictions due to the new, more infectious strain of the coronavirus. There has been travel chaos for millions. People have been trying to get out of the UK before travel bans are enforced. There is major disruption at the main trading corridors between the UK and EU. Global markets have been in disarray due to the deepening health crisis in Europe.
Rather than waiting for other countries to make the first move, epidemiologists are saying the British government should have done the responsible thing and blocked all non-essential travel from the UK.
We have been getting reactions from members of the public in Brussels.
It's maybe a little bit too late to close borders, and I don't think closing borders doesn't help either.
We really have to stick to the situation, to respect it, and then we will, as soon as possible, be able to open everything again.
It's a new thing, we don't know what it is, but we need to act, I think, faster, and maybe in the beginning a little bit harder.
If government imposed like that strict lockdown like they did in South Korea or like North Korea and China, I think there will be riots here.
The European Medicines Agency says it is currently in contact with 46 vaccine developers, and it expects to approve the Moderna jab on the 6th of January. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Can you download an HD movie in 1 second? Thanks to 5G internet? Yes. While around 50 countries have already launched the fifth-generation broadband service, Iran is also jumping on the wagon to roll out the high-speed internet network. Iran's Science and Technology Vice Presidency says 5G coverage will for now be available in the country's Kish Island and will soon reach other regions.
We can now say that Iran is one of the first countries that stepped into this modern technology. We have built the needed infrastructure in Kish Island and at the same time are working on major locations such as Tehran to roll out the technology.
Iran successfully tested 5G in July when users reported a 1.5 gigabit per second of download speed on their mobile phones. However, Iran's ST Vice Presidency says 5G for now will not be offered for household applications and will initially be limited to industrial uses, such as smart transportation.
With 5G's low latency, reliability and powerful connections, we can create an integrated transport network that connects all cars together and also connects personal cars to police for instant guidance and warnings.
Not also in our country, but also most of the countries, 5G infrastructures aren't implemented yet. So we need past time for implementing these infrastructures. And after that, we can use the use cases of 5G.
The deployment of 5G technology is expected to boost Iran's infrastructure for accommodating sensitive online services through domestic servers. Experts say this would significantly increase the cloud computing capacity in the country.
Some 70 million Iranian SIM card owners currently use the third and fourth generation of mobile internet. They still have to wait to see the 5G icon appearing on the top corner of their smartphones. But Iran's ICT officials promised to make 5G internet available for widespread personal use by the end of 2022. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Austrian government announces a third hard lockdown starting immediately after Christmas on the 26th of December. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz had promised that the second lockdown, which ended 2 weeks ago, would save Christmas, but that mission has proven to be nearly impossible. Like the majority of nations around the world, Austrians are not expecting a regular Christmas or New Year's Eve. But things don't look entirely bleak, as vaccinations are set to begin across Europe and Austria on the 27th of December. With every week, says Chancellor Kurz, we get a step closer to ending this pandemic.
Measures will become stricter until the seven-day incident is below 100, and in mid-January there will be free mass tests for everyone who wants to take part.
The goal is to keep weekly cases below 100 per 100,000 people. That number currently stands at just under 200. The lockdown is expected to end on January 18th, but only for those who agree to get tested. For those not willing to take the test, the stay-at-home order and curfew will be in place for another extra week. Health Minister Rudolf Anschober expressed concern over the dramatic increase in mortalities across the country over the last 2 months.
With no further measures, at the end of the month, new cases could range between 1,300 and 3,000 cases a day.
For now, the new restrictions mean everyone entering Austria from abroad has to go into a 10-day quarantine, which can only be cut short after 5 days with a negative PCR or antigen test. Over the Christmas holidays, more contacts and therefore more cases are expected, and the latest preventive measures announced by the government are meant to bridge the time until the vaccine can be rolled out in the new year. Homolezki, Vienna.
The coronavirus pandemic has worsened the dire economic conditions in the blockaded Gaza Strip, leaving a huge impact on the livelihoods of people in the tiny coastal enclave. The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has already caused a sharp decline in the standards of living, as well as alarming levels of unemployment and poverty in the seaside sliver even before the pandemic. Meanwhile, tight lockdown measures to contain COVID-19 have had grave economic implications on all sectors in the Gaza Strip. Experts say the coronavirus pandemic has brought the blockaded enclave's economy to a virtual standstill, driving more Palestinians into poverty.
Economy is a vital lifeline, and the Israeli blockade has crippled this lifeline. The coronavirus restrictions have only worsened the situation. Currently, around 85% of the population live below the poverty line, with an average income of only $2 a day.
Lockdowns are directly affecting thousands of daily wage laborers and their dependents and resulting in suspension of operations in the vast majority of businesses in the Gaza Strip. The coronavirus pandemic has added to the substantial financial strain already felt by many families living in the Gaza Strip.
The coronavirus pandemic has affected economies all over the world. In Gaza, we're suffering the most amid this pandemic because of the ongoing blockade and the lack of resources.
The economy is in a very bad shape, especially during lockdowns, and shops and restaurants are closed. Many businesses had to lay off workers because they can't pay their wages.
The Gaza Strip has logged more than 33,000 coronavirus infections since late August. In an attempt to curb the rapid spread of the deadly virus, local authorities currently impose lockdowns from 6 p.m. until 7 a.m. and a complete curfew on Fridays and Saturdays.
We have imposed lockdowns as part of our preventive measures to slow the spread of the deadly virus. The Ministry of Interior is sparing no effort to minimize the number of coronavirus cases. The number of infections in the Gaza Strip is very high, and we are trying different approaches to contain the virus.
Experts say the pandemic will exacerbate the underlying humanitarian crisis that has gripped Gaza for years.
The COVID-19 pandemic is adding extra strains on Gaza's ailing economy. All economic sectors in the impoverished enclave are already suffering because of the Israeli blockade and multiple wars. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome to the program. Just when things started to go right for Boeing, having recertified its troubled Boeing 737 MAX, new allegations have surfaced, casting doubts on the process to restore the aircraft to the flight line. The article you're about to hear under the heading, New Concerns Emerge After 737 MAX Recertification, has been authored by Dave Makichok. Stay tuned, please, for more on this topic. Just when things started to go right for Boeing, having recertified its troubled Boeing 737 MAX, new allegations have surfaced casting doubt on the process to restore the aircraft to the flight line. The Verge has reported that Boeing and the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration, FAA, worked together to manipulate 737 MAX recertification tests following two fatal crashes in 2018 and 2019, according to a new Senate report. Boeing inappropriately coached some FAA test pilots to reach a desired outcome during the recertification test, and some were even performed on simulators that weren't equipped to recreate the same conditions as the crashes. In doing this, the Senate report's authors say the FAA and Boeing were attempting to cover up important information that may have contributed to the 737 MAX tragedies, The Verge reported. The FAA is also accused of retaliating against whistleblowers, possibly obstructing the Office of Inspector General's investigation into the crashes, failing to hold senior managers accountable, and allowing Southwest Airlines to operate improperly certified planes. The 102-page report was compiled by the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation and is built on information from 50 whistleblowers, FAA staff interviews, and more than 15,000 pages of documents. All MAX planes were grounded worldwide after crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia killed a total of 346 people in October 2018 and March 2019. Last month, the FAA approved the 737 MAX return to service, and flights have resumed in Brazil. According to a whistleblower who was an FAA safety inspector, Boeing representatives watched and gave advice to help test pilots in a flight simulator respond to a nose-down pitch of the plane in a few seconds. The reaction of three flight crews was still slower than Boeing had assumed. According to the report, each time the plane would have been thrown into a nose-down pitch, although recovery would have been possible, the investigator said. Our findings are troubling, Senator Roger Wicker, who chairs the committee, said in a statement. The report details a number of significant examples of lapses in aviation safety oversight and failed leadership in the FAA. It is clear that the agency requires consistent oversight to ensure the work to protect the flying public is executed fully and correctly. The FAA countered that it was an FAA pilot who discovered a separate computer issue in the plane, a flaw that took Boeing additional months to fix. Investigators also said an FAA division manager was first invited, then excluded from a review of the MAX crashes, even though his position normally would call for him to participate in the review. The official said he believes he was excluded to shield the FAA from criticism. Boeing has said that it takes seriously the committee's findings and will continue to review the report in full. The FAA said it was carefully reviewing the document, which the committee acknowledges contains a number of unsubstantiated allegations. The agency added that it is confident that the safety issues that played a role in the tragic accidents have been addressed through the design changes required and independently approved by the FAA and its partners. The report also noted Southwest Airlines was able to operate more than 150,000 flights carrying 17.2 million passengers on jets without confirmation that required maintenance had been completed. The Senate report said the Southwest flights put millions of passengers at potential risk. Southwest did not immediately comment. The 737 MAX was rushed through the development so Boeing could keep pace with rival Airbus, which had surprised announced a more fuel-efficient plane in 2011. Instead of developing a new plane from the ground up, Boeing modified the 737NG with bigger, more fuel-efficient engines. The placement of those engines made the plane susceptible to stalls in certain takeoff situations, though, so Boeing equipped the plane with a piece of software that would automatically pitch the nose down to prevent this from happening. Boeing didn't tell regulators or customers about the software, though, in a bid to cut down on costly flight training. This left the pilots of Lion Air Flight 610 in 2018 and Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 in 2019 fighting, and ultimately losing out to a piece of software they didn't know was working against them. That software, known as Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, that is MCAS, was a big focus of the recertification tests following the two crashes, especially in simulators meant to recreate the crash conditions. The problem broadly that the Commerce Committee found was that this testing process was rife with its own problems. Some FAA investigators left tests early, while others were performed in simulators that weren't equipped with the same software that doomed the 737 MAX flights, meaning the results were meaningless. In one particular FAA test performed on the Wright simulator, a whistleblower says Boeing officials were present and told the test pilots when to hit the switch that killed MCAS. When these actions were reported by whistleblowers, they were often ignored or retaliated against, according to the report. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Cowspiracy, directed by Kit Anderson and Keegan Coon. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Anthony Hamilton, who is a vegan SWP member and student activist. Now, Cowspiracy is a groundbreaking documentary that contends that industrial animal agriculture is the leading cause of deforestation, water consumption, pollution, and even plays a far greater role in global warming than the transportation industry. Cowspiracy manages to expose the capitalist nature and the privatization of the Western food industry, which seeks to protect private company owners and large environmental groups that link back to Congress.
Do you think there should be any concern of us making this documentary?
Of course. If you don't realize right now that you're putting your neck on the chopping block, you know, you better take that camera and throw it away.
It's an environmental disaster that's being ignored by the very people who should be championing.
Let's look at the fundamental problem here.
No one wants to talk about it. Because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions.
The leading cause of environmental degradation is...
We need to address that as well.
It's not up to the Department of Water Resources.
Hard to actually target, like, one thing.
I don't necessarily know what it is.
There's suppression and mismanagement of information everywhere, it abounds.
It starts at the local level, but then it goes all the way to Congress.
When you consider the devastation it's having on our planet as well as the oceans.
And we're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of species in 65 million years.
And they can dictate the federal policies because they have so much political power.
They're one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact, trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating.
That's the one thing no one talks about. Everybody goes around that.
Unfortunately, we are no longer able to fund your film project. We had a meeting, and due to the growing controversial subject matter, we have some concerns that we have to pull out.
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources, and you have nothing.
A lot of people just keep their mouths shut because they don't want to be the next one with the bullet to their head.
I don't know that I would want to comment on that.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And I must say, I found this documentary to be very shocking, thought-provoking, and disturbing all at the same time. And you really do feel a great sense of urgency after watching this documentary to address environmental issues. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic. This documentary was re-released a few years ago, but it's still highly watched and highly relevant to today. What was your take on it?
Well, very much so, and everything that you've mentioned, that and all the above and more, really. And it's quite an impressive first-time feature for these guys. And what they do, which is really interesting, is rather than going for meat eaters and putting them off, which is the obvious thing, they go for the environmental agencies and groups and basically question them as to why they aren't campaigning about this issue, which is greatly affects global warming. I mean, it's pretty shocking. What they also do is, through humour and sparing shock tactics, get the message across too.
He's also on a personal journey, as we learn watching this documentary. He gets very involved. And I thought that was a good style.
Yeah, we've seen it with Michael Moore, but here it's less about him and more about keeping on point and on the question. And some of the stuff is really jaw-dropping.
And Anthony, what was your take on the film?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it. Like you said, about the lack of shock tactics really then allows you to engage in it without feeling as if you're morally obliged to, you know, have to straight away get behind it without seeing the facts and figures and everything like that. So I thought in that sense, you know, it was quite good. It was very critical of the charities, of the people who are supposed to be doing something about this. It was very critical about the lobbyists as well behind it, trying to show the systematic nature of what's going on. I also do think there were a few problems with it. He does seem to pose a lot of the climate change activists against a lot of what he's actually trying to find out, which I think is, you know, a dangerous pit to fall into. In that he seems to target the people who are challenging climate change already in the, you know, activists against fossil fuels and things like this, mm-hmm. as being part of the problem because they're not acknowledging so much the, you know, the stuff around the agriculture industry. And I think it's a bit of a problem. A better way to do it would be to actually link the two together and say this should be a united fight.
But of course, he implies in the documentary that they're sort of in cahoots, perhaps behind the scenes with the political establishment, and that's why they're afraid to speak on this issue. But we'll talk about that a bit more later on. So, Maria, if I could just turn to you. Do you think, before watching this documentary, were you aware that the animal agriculture industry had such a profound effect on global warming?
No, I wasn't. And having seen Al Gore's two films, even less so, because he doesn't tackle it either. And in the film, he is the main inspiration for Kip Anderson. And if this is as important, as huge as these filmmakers are saying, and the film is trying to say, then why aren't the likes of Al Gore tackling this or mentioning it, even just one line in his two films?
And Anthony, I mean, before we move on to our next clip, do you think this documentary at least makes meat eaters think twice and think about becoming vegan, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it definitely has that, because it shows about, you know, there's a lot of talk about individual responsibility and things like that, but it does break it down in quite very obvious terms, uses a lot of nice infographs and stuff, which actually shows your impact on the world, the impact of the meat industry and so on. So I think it does actually, it's really good at exposing that and actually showing people the evidence and letting them make their choice for themselves as well.
We'll have to leave it there just for now.
Clearly, the government did not want to talk about this issue. Their inability to answer, along with the environmental organization's silence on the topic of animal agriculture, made it seem something more was going on. I started doing more investigating on the impacts of livestock and found out this situation was actually worse than I had thought. In 2009, two advisors from the World Bank released an analysis on human-induced greenhouse gases, finding that animal agriculture was responsible not for 18%, as the UN stated, but was actually 51% of all greenhouse gases, 51%. Yet all we hear about is burning fossil fuels. This devastating figure is due to clear-cutting rainforests for grazing, respiration, and all the waste animals produce. This makes animal agriculture the number one contributor to human-caused climate change. But not only that, I found out raising animals for food consumes a third of all the planet's freshwater, occupies up to 45% of the Earth's land, is responsible for up to 91% of Amazon destruction, is a leading cause of species extinction, ocean dead zones, and habitat destruction. Yet, the world's largest environmental groups that are supposed to be saving our world didn't mention this anywhere. I had to speak with environmental organizations to find out why they weren't addressing this issue.
Truly some mind-boggling statistics there. Maria, if we could go back to you, do you think the filmmakers were successful in this film in conveying the threats the environment is under?
I think they were. For me, the most shocking was the fact that Greenpeace wouldn't speak to Kim Anderson, which is just mind-boggling. And why these organisations aren't fighting or bringing these subjects onto, you know, tackling the government over it, but that sort of Michael Moore-ish type sort of assault on the Greenpeace's offices spoke volumes. And then the emails that the correspondence that he received say, oh, we're not this time, you know, not we can't help you this time. You know, when this is, you know, a great opportunity for them to talk out, you know, to speak out and say something.
And Anthony, if I could turn to you now and to address the issues, the main issues raised in this documentary. Of course, what is the link between the animal industrial agriculture industry and also the impact it has on global warming?
Well, I mean, a lot of what was just shown in that clip there, you know, the deforestation, the destruction of habitats, the species extinction, all of these things contribute in a major way. And if you consider this industry, it is an industry. It has, you know, huge, huge amounts of waste, huge amounts of pollution, huge amounts of taking up land simply to grow crops to feed the animals who also take up land as well. It's an incredibly destructive cycle that actually does, you know, I mean, it was very interesting when he spoke to the Oceana person and they said about ethical fishing and so on, but I mean, when he goes through it in detail, there's not really such a thing as the sustainable fishing which they talk about. It, every which way in which the industry constantly expands is destructive.
It is a myth, that's what he suggests in the documentary, which is surprising to hear. So are you suggesting, is there a link between capitalism and global warming? I mean, do you think it's our over-consumer society that is to blame for all these unsustainable methods we're taking?
Absolutely, and if you think about the entire fundamental point in capitalism is about overproduction, it's about constant expansion, finding new fields and areas to be able to conquer and dominate and sell to people. And if you look at the meat industry, the agriculture industry, it is one of those industries which is just growing bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And, you know, with globalization comes that then domination of the globe with this, you know, huge empire behind it, huge amount of lobbyist money. I think that's, you know, he goes and challenges a lot of the leaders of, like you said, Greenpeace and so on. I think that's brilliant, because holding them to account over it really shows the power that this industry has behind it as well.
Maria, do you think the filmmaker puts off people who eat meat from taking part in helping the environment, or do you think he does it in a way that's clever for us to help the environment?
No, I think he was quite clever in the way he put it across, because we've seen in other films, you know, where, you know, you see these animals and the way they're treated and in humane conditions and everything. But here he's showing what the consequences are and the effects to us and to our planet and what we're doing. And it does make you sort of self-conscious about it. And I think meat eaters will think twice, whether or not the term vegan is another matter, but they will take a harder look at what we're doing to our planet.
I mean, we're told constantly to use less water, to change our light bulbs, to recycle. And Anthony, I mean, shouldn't the onus be on the people in positions of power, rather, than the individual to help combat climate change?
Completely. I mean, the idea about just doing small individual things like taking shorter showers and switching off lights and things, while, you know, it is a good activity to get into, it's not going to create the fundamental change which is actually going to save the planet. The fundamental change needs to come from these mass organisations. It actually needs to come from system change in reality, because the way in which this industry is set up, it is to make profit, it is to expand, and it is to not look at the side effects of what they're actually creating, the consequences, which is, you know, constant heating of the globe, constant destruction of rainforests and so on.
And as this documentary suggests also, when you're up against this mass production machine, it's really futile trying to help the environment on an individual level.
Couldn't understand why the world's largest environmental organizations were not addressing this when their entire mission is to help protect the environment.
But that's the thing too, they say, you know, you use less coal, ride your bike, not, you know, less meat.
Yeah. I think they focus grouped it and it's a political loser. In terms of, yeah, because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions, and if they get identified as being anti-meat or challenging people on their everyday habits, that's something that's so dear to people that it will hurt with their fundraising.
They do not want to address the primary driving cause of environmental devastation, which is animal agriculture, because they're businesses and they want to make sure that they have a reliable source of funding.
I had invited to a meeting with Al Gore and some years ago now, and made these methane arguments, and he was really pushback. And that's just his argument. It's hard enough to get people to think about CO2. Don't confuse them.
I think that the problem with a lot of organizations that are focused and have a laser focus don't go off message because they don't want to piss off another whole group of people that will make their lives difficult.
Truly sinister things happening behind the scenes there. Maria, so if animal agriculture is a leading cause of global warming, why has there been so much silence about this issue? I mean, do you think, as the documentary suggests, there's a conspiracy or cowspiracy happening here?
Well, clearly something's happening, and there's a lot of invested interest, according to the film, because the fact that environmental agencies aren't taking up the cause, and that comment about Al Gore was priceless. You know, he's in a great position to have included that in his follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth in An Inconvenient Sequel, and he didn't touch it.
They mentioned that in this documentary, yeah. Actually, that even Al Gore allegedly didn't want to go there as a politician. He knew that it wouldn't help the cause.
But you have to make it the cause. That's what I couldn't get my head around, you know. And that's the thing about this filmmaker. He keeps on message, and he keeps telling you this, and he keeps showing you talking to all these different organizations. You know, I understand lobbyists, I would expect that from them, and to some extent from the government, but from environmental groups, you know, that was the shocker.
I was very surprised to watch that also. And Anthony, do you think, as the documentary suggests, that major environmental groups are purposefully turning a blind eye to the effects of animal agriculture on the environment? I mean, do you think they have any vested interests?
It seemed that way. I mean, from the people he tried to talk to, it was constantly evading his questions. There were times when people, they just went silent and couldn't actually answer his questions. You could tell that they wanted to say something, but it was as if something was stopping them. And I think, you know, there is an unseen power that lies behind these industries, where that pressure, that level of fear that the charities hold over being able to speak out about it is clearly an incredibly pressing issue on them. And I think at the heart of it, one of the things which someone said in the VT just there was that they are businesses and they have funding. And if you look at Kip making this film, he had his funding pulled halfway through the film because they said it was becoming too controversial. You know, as soon as these people, the agriculture industry, feels as if something is going to crush their profits and stop their profits in any way, they straight away jump on top of it and stop it from happening.
And another, go on, sorry.
What was also interesting was that he tackles one of the pro-agriculture people and says, have you invested money, have you funded Greenpeace or one of those organisations? And she, like, stops dead and says, I'd rather not answer that question, or something along those lines, which kind of suggests that they do.
It speaks volumes.
Well,
so either they plead ignorance or they're trying to hide something. And Maria, one of the other shocking things we find out from this documentary is the food disparagement law, which effectively gags people from speaking out against the animal industry. In several states, it's a law that makes it easy for food producers to sue their critics for libel. So who knew speaking against the beef industry would land you in so much trouble?
Indeed, yes, that's a $64,000 question. The fact that they went after Oprah and lost, again, speaks volumes to a certain extent. And the fact that she was sued along with Howard Lyman, who says in the film that if that had happened now, speaking the truth, he would have been, he would have lost
the case. He would have lost, yes. So he's probably lucky that Oprah was behind him on that.
Exactly, or that the Patriot Act wasn't around at that time, maybe.
Were you surprised to know this also, Anthony?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the person who was sued as well alongside Oprah, he himself had ran a farm.
Well, exactly.
A massive, massive farm, and it was him who then actually realised what was going on behind the scenes and tried to speak out about it, just speaking the truth. Mm. And straight away it was clamped down on. And obviously he doing that was an individual. Then it becomes the onus of what are these organisations doing? Actually, they have the clout behind them, they have the membership, they have the power to do something. So it does actually make you think what is going on behind the scenes.
We'll have to pause you there for now. And it was a great discussion.
The animal agriculture industry is one of the most powerful industries on the planet. I think most people in this country are aware of the influence of money and industry on politics. And we really see that clearly on display with this industry in particular. Most people would be shocked to learn that animal rights and environmental activists are the number one domestic terrorism threat, according to the FBI.
And why is that?
It's a difficult question to answer, why these groups are at the top of the FBI's priorities. I think a big part of it is that they, more than really any other social movements today, are directly threatening corporate profits. You know, when we try to find out how factory farms and how animal agriculture is putting the environment, they try to claim exemptions to that information, either under national security terms or public safety, trademark issues, business. It's a business secret. We've seen all these attempts to keep people in the dark about what they're actually doing. You know, one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact, trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating. Through the Freedom of Information Act, we obtained documents from the Counterterrorism Unit that show they're monitoring my lectures, media interviews like this one, my website, my book.
Are we at risk filming this and showing it?
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources. I mean, it's just overwhelming, the amount of money at their disposal, and you have nothing. And I think that fear is a big part of the tactic as well.
Will was right. I was scared. When I learned about the activists being killed in Brazil, I was disturbed, but I felt removed. But to learn about American activists and journalists being targeted by the industry and FBI, my funding being dropped, I was genuinely worried, and it hit close to home. Was this why no one was willing to talk about the issue? I decided to take precautionary measures with all the footage I shot.
We also learned from the documentary that at least 1,000 environmental activists have been killed in Brazil over the last 20 years. Maria, we see Kip Anderson becoming increasingly more nervous and paranoid in the making of this documentary because of what he's up against as he digs deeper. Do you think the filmmakers were brave in making this film?
In some ways, yes. Because once you put your head above the parapet, then, you know, you're in that danger zone. And it's something that's very important, and it's critical that people know about it. So, you know, kudos to them and to him to carry on with making this film, because it's such a vitally important subject, you know.
Do you really think that their lives were at risk, or were they dramatising it, perhaps?
It's not for me to say. It's hard to say. The fact that their funding was removed, and the fact that the FBI apparently, you know, targets journalists, isn't a surprise as such. But I don't know. That verdict's still out on that one.
And Anthony, just following from that clip, we hear that according to the FBI, environmental and animal rights activists are considered the number one domestic threat. Why are you surprised to know this?
I was incredibly surprised, yeah. I mean, given how explosive the world has become, given how turbulent the times that we live in are, if you consider, I mean, you know, this film was made a few years ago, but there are still so many other pressing issues, where there are mass movements about it, where there are protest groups, where there's everything. It's a surprise to see environmental activists and you know, activists against the agriculture industry being up there at the top. I mean, a lot of the time these are people who are in small groups until it breaks through into a much larger thing, like maybe the People's Climate March and that sort of stuff. But until that happens, they're very small groups of people, so it is quite a shocking thing to hear.
I want to bring in Donald Trump now as we end near the end of the program. I mean, he's been criticized for not taking climate change seriously, and he has a record of making some bold tweets, and he's even claimed in one tweet that perhaps China is responsible for global warming as some sort of conspiracy against the US. Anthony, what do you make of Trump's environmental policies?
I mean, I just don't think he knows what he's talking about, really. He has access to a social media account which has possibly the biggest platform in the world right now, and he's able to say whatever he wants, whatever pops into his head at any time without listening to any advisors. And really, it just seems like he doesn't know anything that he's talking about, and everything is always an external enemy. He never does anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with the United States. You know, when it comes to Kim Jong-un and North Korea as well, it's them who are the aggressive ones with the missiles and everything like that. So it's always, there's someone else that's the problem, and it's he's never able to look inwards.
And Mary, what would you say the ultimate message of this documentary is?
Well, that we should all turn vegan, really, if we want to save the planet.
So cutting out meat or eating less is not enough, apparently?
Apparently not.
To reverse the damage that has been caused. Well, I'm afraid it was a really great discussion, but we'll have to leave it there for now. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. And thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The world's major oil forecasters, the International Energy Agency, the U.S. Energy Information Administration, and the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, slowly began to factor the coronavirus into their outlooks, initially seeing its impact limited to China. But by April, it was apparent that the disease was spreading rapidly elsewhere. Forecasts for 2020 oil demand were slashed, and they haven't recovered much in subsequent months, as the statistic chart shows. Oil consumption this year is now expected by all three to be about 10 million barrels a day below the volumes they were forecasting at the end of last year, enough to fuel all of Africa and Latin America. Producers were slow to respond. Seemingly differences between OPEC and its allies sparked a production free-for-all after Russia refused in March to agree to deeper output cuts to help prop up oil supplies. They regrouped the following month and eventually agreed to a record 9.7 million barrels a day reduction from the start of May. We now present you an article written by Julian Lee. The piece is titled, Oil's Vaccine Trade Faces Hurdles Ahead. The article has appeared on the front page of the Bloomberg.com website. Please stay with us for more of Julian Lee's article. It's easy to get caught up in oil's recovery. After an exceptionally fraught year, hopes are high that putting 2020 soundly behind us can only mean better days. But there's still a long way to go to get back to anything like normal. That hard reality didn't stop crude prices from rising by $14 a barrel, or 37% since the beginning of November. That's when trial data showed vaccines were proving effective against SARS-CoV-2, followed by the rapid rollout of the first doses in the United Kingdom and the United States. There's a sense of optimism that hasn't been felt since the world woke up early in the year to a new disease that infected many more people around the world. The relief being felt in the oil market is understandable. As the virus spread, it had a devastating impact on lives and livelihoods. The only tool most governments had to slow contagion was to shut down their economies, causing an unprecedented slump in oil demand. The world's major oil forecasters, the International Energy Agency, the U.S. Energy Information Administration, and the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, slowly began to factor the virus into their outlooks, initially seeing its impact limited to China. But by April, it was apparent that the disease was spreading rapidly elsewhere. Forecasts for 2020 oil demand were slashed, and they haven't recovered much in subsequent months, as statistics charts shows. Oil consumption this year is now expected by all three to be about 10 million barrels a day below the volumes they were forecasting at the end of last year, enough to fuel all of Africa and Latin America. Producers were slow to respond. Seemingly differences between OPEC and its allies sparked a production free-for-all after Russia refused in March to agree to deeper output cuts to help prop up oil prices. They regrouped the following month and eventually agreed to a record 9.7 million barrels a day reduction from the start of May. Further supply cuts came from producers outside of OPEC Plus group, as budgets were slashed and some operations didn't make economic sense anymore. US crude production, which had already peaked in November of last year, fell by 2.7 million barrels a day, or 21%, between March and May of this year. Around one-third of that has been restored in subsequent months. The sluggish response sent oil stockpiles soaring, storage tanks filled, ships were pressed into service to hold excess volumes and spare capacity at Cushing, Oklahoma, the delivery point for the West Texas Intermediary crude contract, dwindling briefly, sending prices tumbling into negative territory for the first time ever. By the end of October, oil stockpiles in the developed nations of the OECD were still above the peak reached during the 2016 surge that preceded the formation of OPEC Plus, even though they had been falling for the previous 3 months. Production discipline among the OPEC Plus producers, who've been kept in line by main producing countries, has created the supply deficit needed to draw down stockpiles. Although the cartel's de facto leaders haven't called out the group's second largest overproducers in volume terms, they have been prepared to ruffle feathers closer to home, singling out some countries like the United Arab Emirates for failing to abide by their production targets. As a result, the group's overall compliance with its output targets has been better than anyone expected. But there's still a long way to go. The latest forecasts from the three agencies show global oil demand lagging the corresponding 2019 levels throughout next year, and that's even with all the positive vaccine news. And the outlook's getting worse, not better. OPEC's own analysts have cut their forecasts for 2021 oil demand with each new report since July, when they first began publishing quarterly numbers for next year. The demand recovery is patchy, both geographically and sectorally, and it's likely to stay that way. It's also going to be very susceptible to the ups and downs of the battle to defeat the coronavirus pandemic. Tighter restrictions are once again in place in much of Europe and in some significant markets in Asia. New cases are rising in South Korea, although the country is not yet at the point of lightening social distancing rules, while a fresh wave of infections is causing challenges for Japan's fragile recovery. Different recovery speeds for different products are creating their own challenges for the refining sector, while diesel demand is picking up as online shopping boosts the need for delivery trucks. Jet fuel consumption is still being hammered, with commercial flights stuck at about 60% of comparable levels last year. Those disparities are unlikely to change anytime soon, with many people likely to remain wary of flying for months to come. The approval of effective vaccines marked the beginning of a post-pandemic world. But we'd be foolish to think that just because we can see a finish line, it means we've actually reached it. There's still a long way to go, and the next few months will be tricky, both for the people's health and well-being, and for economies around the world, and also for the oil sector.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 20.